Hello, hello. This episode is about The Walk. I'm blessed to speak with my man, Conrad Carr, aka The Condor, a living legend from Malibu. He's a professional surfer that just walked from New York to Florida, over 1,000 miles. This is a story about how he did it, why he did it, where he comes from, living in Russia for 2 years, preaching the gospel on a Mormon mission trip by himself in Siberia. This is before he did the walk. And then we get into speaking about the 60-day process from Times Square down to Cocoa Beach. Conrad got robbed. He got shot at. He slept with hobos. He posted up on the outside of Waffle Houses. I mean, he just did it all. You got to listen to this. So interesting. Literally a living legend. The Condor. This is the story of The Walk.
Serious.
One time.
This is fucking unreal, man. I'm excited to talk about The Walk.
Let's do this.
All right, this is awesome. Okay, start off growing up from Malibu. Give me the young Condor story. How you even turned into the Condor? Give me like the start me from when you were, say you're 15 or whatever in Malibu as a surfer, because I know that you turned pro real early.
Yeah. So young Condor, back in the day, grew up in Paradise Cove, Malibu, which is a great little nook, great waves. And I just, basically two big things were kind of ran my life. I was a surfer since I was a little kid, and I was Mormon since I was a little kid. And so when I was 11, 12, I started surfing, got sponsored by Quicksilver, and I rode for Quicksilver from when I was 13 to 19, and then when I was 19, I went on 2 years.
Wow, that early.
Yeah.
Dang.
And then from 19 to 21 was the 2 year Mormon mission. So it was surfing.
Your whole family was Mormon.
Yeah. I was raised Mormon, and now it's funny because everyone is kind of out of it now, pretty much. So.
Is there a lot of Mormons in Malibu?
No, there's no Mormons in Malibu. So I was kind of, you know, different than kind of your classic like Utah Mormon, and that showed when I went on my mission. What I thought a mission was you're preaching all day and just like, you know, going after everyone on the street, because I talked to everyone. Everyone was like, he literally talks to everyone.
Yeah, I remember, but you telling me that.
Yeah, so that was my whole deal in in Utah. You start the mission 2 months in the MTC and it's like super intense. And then you go off and you go to your place, and mine was Siberia. And when I got to Siberia,
wait, so you start you're in Malibu and you're like 13, 14, 15, whatever, surfing, and didn't you turn pro?
Yeah, well, I got paid for a couple years when I was like 17 to basically when I was 19 and left on the mission. I was
at 19 you're like required to go and move somewhere to serve for Mormonism.
Yeah, pretty much required. Guys are pretty much, you got
to
go.
And you went to Salt Lake City first?
Yeah, I went to Provo. It's called the Missionary Training Center, MTC. And that's where it all
started.
What
is that? Yeah, what was that? What is that like going from Malibu to a missionary training center when you're a Mormon kid living on the beach, heading out to Salt Lake City? That's a totally different climate, totally different group of people.
Yeah, that was the roughest part of the whole mission, actually, was Utah, just because it was like 10 hours a day of straight studying, you know, learning how to preach the gospel, learning the Russian language, the scriptures, all that. It was, you know, really intense.
Do they teach you Russian at the training center?
Yeah. I mean, we thought we learned Russian when we were there for like 2 months. And then when I got to Russia, I was like slap in the face. I don't know a thing, because it sounded totally different than what I was learning.
Ooh.
But Yeah, no, the MTC was intense. Like, so for me, when I went on the mission, I thought, like, this is, you know, the most spiritual thing. This is me, you know, I really thought, you know, I might see God. I'm going to have some crazy spiritual experiences, which I did. I didn't, I guess, see God, but I had some experiences that were so amazing. But I also saw, I met a lot of Muslims over there, and I saw people in, you know, the Muslim faith, Buddhists, and they had similar spiritual experiences where I thought, man, like, the ones I had seemed to me like proved sort of the, you know, this is the exclusive way to God, but theirs, they're having
like Mormonism.
Yeah, Mormonism.
Yeah, yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, I'm seeing these Muslims are having these crazy signs, or in my head I'm thinking, well, if that happened to me, I'd be like, wow, that's, you know, kind of God showing them the way. Whereas, you know, my companions would be like, no, you see how they're wrong. I never really argued when I was on the mission. I never.
You mean like, yeah, you mean like the people, the other Mormon kids that you were with would be like, yo, there's no way that they felt that because they're not Mormon. When you,
yeah.
You were like, yo, it sounds like their experience is pretty similar to our experience. Like, maybe there's something more to this.
Yeah, exactly. The being in Russia, it almost opened my eyes because we'd end up having these long, you know, theological debates with people.
Okay, so wait, you're in Utah for how long before you get transported over to Russia?
2.5 months, and it's like, you know, it's intense. I'll tell you a funny story. When we first got there, you know, I'm a Mormon kid, but, you know, I'm living in Hawaii, I'm surfing, you know, Hawaii, living there for the last year, just, you know, my schedule. I didn't really go to high school. I was homeschooled because, you know, I'm traveling, got my sponsors. And I get to this place, this missionary training center, and it's so regimented. And they have these, it was, I think we were 2 days in, and this guy's giving a big sermon thing. There's everyone's in the big, you know, classroom, a huge classroom. And the guy, he hands out this thing called a white handbook, and it's basically like your rule book. And he goes, you know, well, everyone read this white handbook, and it's like 100 pages. He goes, well, everyone read this by Sunday night. And it's like Friday night. And I'm thinking, man, I don't know if I'll be able to finish that thing, 100 pages in like a day or two. And so everyone raises their hand, and I didn't raise my hand. And then he goes, did anyone not raise their hand? And I'm like, oh crap. And I raised my hand, and I'm thinking like, you know, you gotta be honest. This is a mission where I'm trying to see God. You know, if yeah. I'm really doing this, I gotta be, you know, 100% honest. And so he walks to the back of the room where I was sitting, and he takes the handbook thing and he whacks me in the head with it. And he's like, real funny, huh? And
I was no just way.
Like, yeah, and I'm just like straight faced. And he's like, you're kidding, huh? And I'm like, no, I'm just, you know, a little worried. I don't think I could finish this thing. And so I want to be honest. You know, you guys, we're all like, you know, representing God here. I don't want to lie to, you know, I don't want to lie to nobody. I'm like real nervous about this whole situation. And yeah. he was really like kind of, he didn't get it at all. And so he took me in the back room and then we talked it out and we ended up being friends. But he was just
wow.
Like,
now looking back at that, looking back at the whole training of the Mormon at the Mormon Center, do you like have different views about it? Or are you like, yo, I'm a little bit not skeptical, but are you a little bit like some of the stuff that they was a little bit extreme, or was a little bit like too much, or did you still love it, or what?
Well, I think in everything with the Mormon Church, it's. And I guess with others, I think the Mormon Church is basically, you know, perfect in its sense. And part of me thinks, one of my theories is that God puts us in these different places, because I believe in God, and I think he'll put us in different situations in life so that it'll help us. And so Mormon might be one of them, or the Buddhist might be one, or Muslims might be one, or different, you know, walks of life where people grow up in their cultures. I think God puts people there to in those things there and matches them up to help them. But I think in the Mormon Church, the traditions and the cultures and sort of the how people interpret things, that gets a little iffy. And so you'll have people in the training center who are a little too extreme, you're right, where the, you know, people will focus more on the letter of the law instead of the spirit of the law.
Totally, but I think that's the same way as I feel that way about every religion, though.
Yeah, and the thing about, you know, a really cool story that people don't know is that Joseph Smith, in the early days of the Mormon Church, he was so fed up with everyone focusing like, oh, he was doing this or he was doing that. And a big thing in Mormon Church is you don't smoke and drink. And Joseph Smith, the leader of the church, the prophet, he rode down the street with a big cigar in his mouth, and he's like, everyone needs to chill out, basically. So the story goes.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know a ton about Mormonism, but that's the exact same way that I feel about... I know Mormonism from you, but I don't know, like, the depths of it, but that's the same way that I feel about Christianity or Catholicism, like, that I feel like the book is almost taken literally rather than, like... You have to look at it through like the context of when it was written, and it's been passed down, and it's been like everything's written in such a different context than the way that it is right now in the world. So
yeah,
I think the extremes of religion is where it gets to be a little bit kind of over the top.
The extremes, and then anything that obviously causes, you know, fighting or wars, that's obviously counterintuitive. And then also, you got to think Jesus, when he was on earth, his what seemed like his least favorite people were not the sinners, but those who, you know, judged, and those who were hypocrites, and those who got too caught up in the sort of traditions, and too caught up in the letter of the law, and too caught up in, you know, keeping everyone by the rules, and ended up being hypocrites and judging others. Those were his least favorite people, the, you know, totally. Pharisees and the Sadducees, you know. And then that brings me to another point of, yeah, extremism is tough in religion, and I'd say in politics and in health. I think those are the three mysteries of the earth right now, is health, politics, and religion. I don't think we'll ever really know, but we always should try our best. But I think another thing besides extremism is structure, and religion brings structure, just like the school, the education system brings structure. But, you know, a big argument against, like, the education system or against religion is, you know, you don't need these things anymore. You don't need religion to be spiritual. You don't need school to get an education. But you've got to argue, too, that structure sort of induces us to do it. Because you got to think, you know, maybe 9 out of 10 college kids, they wouldn't ever learn anything on their own if their parents said, okay, you have a choice. You can, you know, get good books from libraries and off the internet for the next 4 years, or you got to go to school. If they chose the first, they wouldn't actually do it. They need structure to actually get anything done. And I think that's in school, that's in religion, that's in a lot of these things that some people think are, you know, things of the past, but also I think help society today in ways with that structure.
Right, I agree with that. But that just goes back to what you were saying, is when it becomes too extreme, is when it kind of gets over the top. Like, yeah. With all three of those, I think there's almost like a middle way.
Yeah.
Not too little, to where you're saying like the kid that's not going to school and not doing anything with their lives and just sitting around, to the kid that is literally so obsessed with school that he has absolutely no social life. Neither are the right extreme. The middle way is almost the way that should be desired.
I like that. The middle path.
Yeah, the middle path. That's I think that's exactly what the Tao is, and non-duality. Just like that everything is all one, and that it's there's no two extremes, right? You know, like the yin and the yang, you don't want to be swinging either side of the pendulum too far. You want to kind of just stay in the middle.
Exactly. And those, I think you kind of see, there's a lot of the happiest people in life. They're really good examples of that. And I'm always looking at them like, how do they, you know, they balance everything, and they're moderate with, you know, their things, and they can do a little bit of that and still be good, and they're happy, you know, their family, their work, this, totally. That.
Totally. Yeah. It's balance. It's so, yeah. And that's why balance is so important. It's like, yeah, just I think extremism is just something that'll kill you. Being so far tipped over to one side will just get you burned at the end.
Yeah, and I try to stay balanced, but I'm Irish. It's hard for some people to stay balanced. It's and that was one thing I did when I went to Russia. afterwards, I was like, you know what? Even then, in Russia, I tried to never be too extreme. I always realized, like, I'm on a mission. It's all about God and love. I'm not going to argue with a Jehovah's Witness about who's right and wrong here for the next 3 hours. Like, that's not hitting the point. That's completely missing
the point. Where do you think fear comes into play with all of that, with religion and, I guess, even school and stuff like that? But just about in organized religion, do you think that a lot of it is played off of people being scared, like of a God that's judgmental and that's going to, if you don't do this the right way, or if you do drink and you do smoke, you do have sex, you're going to get banned, or you're going to get abolished, and you're going to get... Do you feel that fear is just like a huge part in that extreme type of religion?
Yeah, I think it is. I don't know to what extent, because on one end, you know, it's if fear is what really created religion, and you know there is no God, but I think there is. Then, you know, fear is the root of everything. We created it to give us, you know, solace that we'll live again after we die and we'll be together and this and that. But I don't think it's that. I don't think it's to that end. I think it's more, I think there is a God, and so there's good beliefs that, you know, and things will happen, and, you know, I think there is a life after death, but I think the fear came in when people sort of, like, you know, got scared of things and then created rules to give them comfort. And so I don't know, for me it is tough, because there's a lot of, like, you know, fear and guilt. You feel those because you fear it,
totally.
And then you screw up and you're like, oh, I screwed up, I'm guilty. And so there's a lot of that. Me, I don't think I have it as bad, but I know a lot of people who are, you know, Mormons or different extreme religions, and they're like, you know, they feel terrible when they do something bad. But I always think at the end of the day, I'm like, you know what? I know my religion pretty well. And the very basis of it is God loves, God forgives, Jesus died for us. So that's, like, you know, always in the back of my mind. I'm not, you know, practicing Mormon anymore, but I always think that in the back of my mind. Like, if I did screw up real bad, you know, at the end of the day, as long as I'm, like, humble and say, like, I did screw up, and I have my whole life. Like, that's the premise of Christianity. Mormon is Christianity. Is, you know, God loves, God forgives, Jesus paved the way for all that, you know?
Totally.
So.
Okay, so you were in Salt Lake City, and then they transport you over to Russia. Run me through where you're at, how, fuck, man. You go from Malibu to Russia.
Yeah.
I did the same thing, Malibu to Russia, but you were literally, like, living in Malibu for years growing up there. I was only there for, like, a year. But Malibu to Russia, you're on the streets of Russia. What city were you in? Run me through living out there. What's the living situation like? What do you have to do? What are you required to do?
Yeah, so I remember flying in. We flew in on 9/11 of... not that year, but later on I was scared. We flew into Moscow. My first impression was cigarettes and hot woman, and I don't think that ever changed. Everyone smokes, and there's hot girls everywhere, especially. So I was in Siberia. That was where my mission was like five different cities in Siberia. And so I lived in Novosibirsk and Kemerovo most of the time. And Kemerovo was like the coal mining capital of Siberia. It still is. And it's just, to me, it's Kemerovo is like the most distant place on earth. Like, you can't get any more, like, just alien, you know, 90s, you know, alien apocalypse America. It's crazy. It's, I don't know. Kemerovo for me was, I felt so alive when I first got there. That's the first place I went, and then where I ended. So I was there for about a year in total.
You felt so alive.
Yeah, well, for me, I was in Utah in a classroom all day, and then they fly me out to Russia, where I finally get to go preach and do my thing. And I got the Book of Mormon, and I'm walking around, and I'm, like, seeing all these people, and I'm talking to everyone. And I didn't understand a word they were saying. They didn't understand me.
But oh, God.
It was just so much fun.
What was the living? Like, where would you, how did you guys, how many people were you with? Where'd you guys live?
So Kemerovo, right? It's,
right.
And I told my, there's a mission president. So there's 70 Mormon missionaries in Siberia, and Siberia is like the size of America. So that means sometimes there's a city where there's just you and your companion there. And that was the case for me. And I told my mission president, I met him in Utah, because he was just flying out to Siberia too. And I told him, I said, look, I want to go to like the coldest, meanest, craziest place ever. Because for me, I'm 19 and I really wanted adventure. I wanted to see the world. I wanted to see God. I wanted to experience, you know, life. This totally. For me was like the crux of my life. And so I think he kind of, you know, he got his inspiration and that. And he said, okay, you're going to Kemrova, where there's no missionaries. We're going to open up the place. And so wow. It was me and one other elder, Elder Eborn, great kid from Utah. And so he was an experienced missionary. But he was just like, this kid is crazy. Because I was talking to everyone. And I remember sometimes he'd be like, you better like stop talking to people because like you're making us late to meetings and different things. I'm like, well, I just like, this is the greatest time ever.
Didn't you say that your goal every day was to not let one person pass you without talking to you?
Yeah. And I didn't, I talked to literally everyone. it was almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Cause in the beginning I talked to everyone. But then other missionaries kind of saw that and were like, yo, that kid talks to everyone. And so then it got back to me like this thing where Elder Carr doesn't let anyone pass them without talking to him. And so then it was like, okay, I got to live up to my name. And so then it was like full on rest of my mission. That was what I did. And the president knew that. So he always just was like, you just talk to everyone. That's what you do.
Did any of the people ever get pissed off at like some of those Russian people ever get pissed off and push you or?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. But that's what made it. That's what gave me life every day was I felt I was God's instrument. I'm out there doing his work and I'm having the greatest time ever. And I knew what it looked like. And so sometimes I'd joke around and I got to reading them so well where, you know, I could tell if some guy was like really nervous, I'd be like, look, yeah, I'm gonna, you know, I'm from the FBI, I'm coming for you. Or I'd be like, you know, yeah, I'm gonna here to, you know, take one of your Russians home and marry her, get my Russian wife, you know, if they're with girls. So I'd have fun with them, but I'd have such a good time. But then I'd talk to homeless people and drunks all the time too. And so that'd get crazy. One time I got slapped in the face, one time I got punched in the face. One time I was going up the metro, up the stairs, and some dude, I think he'd recognize me. He was like, oh, yeah, I'm not, you know, he's yelling at me, and then he grabs me, and he just throws me down the stairs. That was
Jesus.
Intense.
Seriously?
Yeah.
One wow. time I so, got choked. So are you living when you're over there, you're just living in an apartment with the dude, or just a dorm, or what?
Yeah, me and Elder Eborn were on the river. The Ove River, I think, in Kemerovo was.
What do they tell you that you have to do when you go over there on those mission trips? Like, do they give you a set schedule, or like, what are you required to do every day?
Yeah, so that white handbook, I mentioned it earlier. You basically have your regiment there. So you get up 6:30, work out, shower, eat breakfast.
They got you working out?
Yeah, you work out for like 20 minutes, but it's kind of however you want to do it. I'd always just do push-ups. Do my little surf exercise because I always wanted and believed when I got back from my mission I'd surf better than ever and that'd be all good, which it was. I did an air reverse, my main trick, the first week back from Russia.
Wow.
But anyway, so it's basically all morning you're studying. So 8 in the morning till midday to lunchtime, you're reading the Book of Mormon, you're studying the Preach My Gospel in Russian. And then you go out on the street from midday, 12 o'clock, always till 9:30 at night. And we had a rule, one of the Area 70s called, one of the head honchos from like Salt Lake. He came out and he said, and this was the coldest winter Russia had in 70 years. And he comes out and he says, you guys have to stay out. You can't be indoors till 9 o'clock at night. And so we'd be out freezing, just walking the streets, roaming the streets. And luckily that winter, there was this mall that was open and we'd preach in there until they kicked us out. And then And then we'd be out on the streets freezing. I got frostbite one time. My nose was all white. It was funny because...
No way.
Yeah, I'm walking with this my companion. He didn't like me too much because he was new. And this was towards the end of my mission. And he was, you know, he didn't even want to be there at all. And he was there. He was kind of there by the tradition of the Mormon kind of thing. He was from Utah. He's like, no, I don't even really know this stuff. I don't even believe it. I'm like, you don't believe it. Why are you here? You should just head home. He's like, no, I could never do that. And he like kind of confided in me. And I was like, one day, I was like, well, maybe just jump off the balcony, break your legs. I won't say anything. He's like, trust me, I've been thinking about it. And so you got to think, a kid like that, so much pressure to go on the mission. He didn't want to go,
yeah,
you know?
For sure.
So I'm walking with him one night, and I see these ladies in a car. And so I'm you know, doing my thing, like Book of Mormon, you know? And the lady's like yelling at me something. And then she's like pointing at me. I'm like, yeah, like, okay, like, here you go. Here's like thinking she wanted the book or to meet up and so we could give her the lessons. But instead, she starts pointing at my nose. And then I kind of, like, you know, pointed my nose. And then Elder Theobald, he looked at it and he was like, oh, just gasping. And I was like, what? And he's like, your nose is completely white. So we sprinted home. And then that was my frostbite. It was
Holy
funny.
Holy shit.
Because that same street, another time I was with Elder Theobald, and we see a car accident. And so we're like, okay, like, I'd run in there, see if we can help. Because missionary, you're always trying to help and serve and, you know, do anything you can to spread good. You know, that's what I tried to do. And so I see this accident, and this guy gets out, and this girl, and they look really flustered. And I'm like, oh, they just got in an accident. And I talk to them, and they're pretty weird. And it was just, you know, rear end, so it wasn't bad. And so they're getting back in the car, and they're like, you guys are cool. You guys want to cruise with us? And I was like, to Theobald, yeah, let's go. And so we get in the car. And then no sooner do I realize why they'd gotten in an accident, because they were high as hell and they had like needles and they were shooting up in the car. And my companion from Utah, he had no idea what was going on. And so I pulled out a Word of Wisdom pamphlet, which is like, don't smoke, don't drink, do drugs thing. And I start preaching to them, almost joking, though. Yeah.
No way. What did they say?
As their eyes are rolling back in their heads. And I'm just thinking, like, we need to get out of this car.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in the moment, it was almost this just such a surreal moment as I'm preaching to them about, you know, don't do drugs, smoke, and drink. And their eyes are rolling back in their heads. And I think they were, you know, shooting up on heroin. They were shooting something up.
How long are you over in Russia for this, over the whole span of it?
2 years. 2 years. And every 3 months, you go to Finland and renew your visa. And I mean, it was an adventure of a lifetime. Russia was
incredible. You didn't leave Russia, aside from going to go get the visa, you didn't leave Russia for 2 years.
No, I didn't see the ocean for 2 years.
What about your family?
Who lived in it? No, I didn't see my family for 2 years. You're only allowed to email them once a week, and then you talk to them on the phone twice a year.
You are fucking kidding me. You only talk to your family on the phone twice a year during those 2 years.
Mother's
I didn't know it was
Day.
That intense.
Yeah.
Well,
Mother's
you're in
Day
Russia.
And Christmas.
What are you? You say Mother's Day?
Mother's Day and Christmas. That's
what
the
is
two
your mom
times
thinking
here.
Like the whole time while you're gone? Did your brother go do? You have an older brother. Did he go do this too?
I had an older brother. No, the day I left, he said, "This is the worst thing ever." And my mom said, "This is a happy day too," you know. And he's all, "No, this is terrible." He was really bummed.
Did he go to Russia and do it too?
No, he didn't go on a mission. He was, you know, kind of against the whole thing. Pretty early on.
Okay.
That happens to a lot of Mormons, you know, when they feel too much pressure, they kind of spin the other way.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Wow. So. Okay. And so you're in Siberia for 2 years. How does it feel? How does it feel leaving there, going back to Malibu after not seeing the ocean, not seeing people, none of that stuff?
Yeah, that's something I've tried to figure out with my life. Is the happiest I've ever been in my entire life was right when I got home from Russia. And I don't know if that was because I was in Siberia, the coldest place, and then right when I got home, I got to go on all these awesome surf trips. or if it was God blessing me with, you know, 2 years of service, now life's going to be good and I'm going to give you a really happy peace of mind. I think it was a combination of both. But yeah. Getting home, I remember it'd be like a month where I was just relishing food, and then it'd be a month where I was just like my friends, and then it'd be another month where it was, oh, surfing is so good, and then it'd be a month where, wow, girls, I can hug girls and, you know, try and, you know, make things happen with girls and kiss girls, because on the mission you can't even hug a girl, you can't, like, it's zero, nothing, you know.
Wow.
And so that was hard. That was the hardest thing on the mission, is because these Siberian girls are so hot. And I'd tell my mission president sometimes and say, like, these girls are, like, unreal. I struggle. I think about the girls a lot. And I want to talk to the girls on the street more than the guys. And he's like, no, it's okay. Like, you're a man at the end of the day. You're still a man. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. What do all the other Mormon kids do? They just don't talk to girls for 2 years wherever they go?
Yeah, a lot of them don't. And for me, it was like, it was such a nice bonus when I talked to a girl. And I'll tell you, so Kemerovo, where I first started, when me and Elder Eborn first got there, there was one person who showed up at church that day. And it was in an old hair salon. That's where we held the service. We rented out a hair salon. And then by the end of my 2 years there, we had like 20 to 30 people come into that old hair salon every Sunday. And I ran the service. And it was funny because most of the people, so I had, I think, 7 baptisms. I think about 11 where I was involved. But that was, you know, that's 7's quite a lot for Russia.
You were baptizing people in Russia?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, and I was the leader of the group there in Kemerovo. So I ran church service. I was giving the speech. You know, the surfer guy from Malibu was running Sunday, you know, services.
And you're running this in the Russian language. You're not speaking English.
Yeah, in Russian. And the thing is who I sort of attracted, I guess you could say, was we had a lot of mentally challenged guys showing up and a lot of girls my age. That was pretty much who I had coming. I, you know, had girls my age and mentally challenged dudes.
And yeah, so and every one of those girls was just wanted to bang you, not didn't care about the Mormonism, but they were just like, who's this surfer kid that is knows how to speak Russian somehow?
Yeah, they were hyped on that for sure. It was wild. It was a madhouse for a bit. But
when you got back, what are you supposed to do when you come back from those trips? Like with the Mormonism, like with your service, what is it required of you to do when you get back from those?
So it's sort of, you're not required, but it's kind of just happens where you get married. You get married in the next like 5 years after you get home. You go finish up school. You get married, you get a job. And yeah, that for me was where I kind of split was, I think I felt, whether it was me or whatever it was almost like pressure or just a thing where I got to get married. And I sort of dated around some different Mormon girls and I wasn't feeling it. I wanted to kind of venture out and, you know, hang out with other girls. And that's kind of where I just went off was, well, it was actually, I went off with Dylan, with his dad, and that's where I had my first drink with Dylan's dad.
So when you got back, were you like gung-ho on continuing with doing your Mormon stuff, or were you kind of like, you know, I'm a little bit over this, or were you just kind of whatever? What was your feeling like after about 6 weeks of being home?
Ooh, after 6 weeks, I'd gone on a few surf trips. So Dylan, you know Dylan and Brandon, me and Dylan went to Tahiti, we went to Hawaii, we went to Nicaragua, and I was kind of just living life. You know, I wasn't partying or anything, but I was just so happy to be surfing and everything. I wasn't, I guess, thinking as much about God and things, but after a bit, I just kind of started to kind of waver a bit from just like, okay, you gotta find a girl to marry. And part of me was like, you know, I want to go experience the other side of life and maybe go off and experience something else and not be so strict and into my thing. And right. So I ended up, you know, partying for a couple years, going out to the clubs. Where you and Joe and the boys out to Hollywood?
Was that the same time?
Yeah, I don't know. You knew me right when everything was sort of transitioning.
What year was it that you got back?
I got back 2013, and then 2014. When I was 22, that's when I, you know, had my first drink, lost my virginity in Chase's house. So you were probably right, so, there.
And so when all that is happening, are you kind of, or did you make a switch to be like, I'm not going to dedicate my life to this, to the point of like going and getting married?
Yeah, I think it was sort of the thing where it's like, and a lot of it was hanging out with you guys, with you, Chase, Hunter.
Wow, I feel so bad that we've ruined that for you.
You guys totally ruined it for me, but you guys were such great guys, and you're happy, and you do good in the world, and you weren't so, obviously you didn't have a strict regimented religion you were following, and so for me that was a bit of an eye-opener, seeing you guys, and then also just kind of wanting to see if, you know, a different sort of mental model or a different sort of lifestyle worked
totally.
or brought happiness, because I feel like it either route would have been good. If I stayed Mormon, I'd always would have been wondering like, oh, what would it be like if, you know, if I went off and did some other crazy things, and now that I've done those things, sometimes I think, oh, what would it have been like if I, you know, found this sweet Mormon girl and just got married to her. I think either way, you always wonder a little bit.
Yeah, the grass is never greener.
Yeah.
On the other side.
Yeah.
But still, I think that the place that you're at right now, I think that you don't have to be religious to be spiritual and to live through love and live as a good person and spread good to the world. Like you were just saying, like your mission was to just constantly spread good, and I don't see that anything changed from you aside from actually considering yourself following the Book of Mormon to now you being like almost your own mix of a couple things. You're still spreading good to the world the same exact same way.
Sometimes I'd agree. I'd say usually less, but when I do things like the walk, which I'm guessing we'll get to, that had a super similar feel to the mission. Like almost when I look back on my life, the two things I'm probably most proud of is the walk and the mission and surfing. I'd say those three things.
All right, well let's talk about the walk then. So from what I heard, it started on just on a plane ride. So break it down. Tell me where it's how the whole fucking thing started.
Yeah, so we were flying into New York. We're with Rick and Rick Solomon. He's the greatest dude on earth, I'd say. Most generous, good person. And we were like betting things like how much to do this, how much to do that. It was, he said how much to walk to Florida. And I was like, I'd do it for like 50 grand, New York to Florida. And he's like, oh, maybe we'll do it. And I was like, oh, like, yeah, I think maybe I'll do this. And then we were just sort of thinking about it, joking about it. And then a couple weeks later, we kind of had the idea to, you know, raise a bunch of money for the hurricane animals, because we were surfing the hurricane swell in New York. And so Rick made a deal with me that he'd pay me the money, plus he'd give 100 grand to the hurricane animals too. And so Rick put up all this money, and he ended up giving me, well, his buddies ended up giving me more money as I walked, which kind of, you know, sort of this somewhat selfish part of it was, you know, every week he was like, look, my other buddy's gonna throw you another 10 grand. And I'd be like, okay, I can do this. Cause I almost gave up day two, And then
the bet was to walk from New York, like the cat, like literally like Times Square, all the way down to what to where in Florida?
To Florida. That was my bet with Rick. And for me, what I wanted was 1,000 miles. So that is like, you know, 100 miles past the border. And so I had to walk basically to this place called Palm Coast.
Okay.
And so.
And when you and once you did it, once you guys agreed on it, you didn't train for it. You didn't like you hadn't even been fucking working out. You've been surfing a little bit, but
I did nothing. It was crazy because we were just in New York surfing, cruising around, you know, eating Cipriani's, eating good food. And then I was like, all right, I'm doing this. And everyone was like, no, just wait till next year. Like, come on, you gotta plan this out. This is a crazy thing. And I'm like, no, I'm going to try and just freaking run this thing and get it done in like 3 weeks. And so I knew like, you're not going to do it next year. You got to do it now or never. And so I just literally the day before I went, because I was there with Malia at the time because Rick and Brandon went home and me and Malia were still hanging. And she was surfing New York, and we went to REI, I think it's called, and I got a backpack, Patagonia, I got a little mat, spent like, you know, $500 or something, and Rick was giving me money to get all set up and everything too. I was like, all right, I gotta do this. And then the next day, just walked out of Malia's apartment there.
I didn't know this, so you didn't even like go back to Malibu and plan for it or anything. Like we're just in New York and we're like, fuck it, I'll do it.
I had these nasty pants I was wearing, I think, and I didn't have
What equipment did you end up taking with you for the walk?
It was literally just, so, and that was a cool part of it was, so Rick was like, well, if we're gonna do this, let's try and make something out of it. And so I called Liam Hemsworth, you know, the actor. And he's a good friend of mine from surfing. We met out surfing the rock in Malibu, I don't know, a few years back. And we're just instant brothers, you know. Love the guy. He's one of the greatest dudes I ever met. You know, he's in the limelight, all that. But then he's just such a humble, kind person. I've never seen anything like it. Like, he's just the most solid guy.
Yeah, I've heard that. You told me that a bunch.
Yeah, he's the most solid guy. I mean, between him and Rick, it's like those are the two best dudes. And to have their support on this walk, I was like, oh, I'll do this, you know, the best I can. And I almost gave up. But if it weren't for them, the walk never would have happened. Because I called Liam, and he was like, oh, animal. So I asked him, you know, what's a good animal organization? He was like, let me see what Miley
weren't
says.
Weren't you working for one at the time?
I was working like for Sea Shepherd. And Sea Shepherd's great. They were dealing with some legal stuff at the time, but Sea Shepherd's awesome. But they don't do hurricane stuff. And so we wanted to make it local. Since I'm walking New York to Florida, it'd be perfect to help all these displaced, you know, there's a bunch of cats and dogs who are struggling in Florida, Puerto Rico. And so then Miley called that night and was like, do it with Happy Hippies. Happy Hippies works with Humane Society. Do it with them. And she was celebrating, I think, something like 9 months of sobriety or something. They were having a fun night. And so they were going out. It was funny. But anyway, so I ended up teaming up with Miley's foundation, Happy Hippies, and her and Liam were supporting it. And Liam was filming a movie in Savannah, Georgia, like in a month from that time. And I was like, oh, I might walk right through. And he said, well, you walk through Savannah, say what's up, I'll be there. And so that was a huge goal, was just make it to Savannah. And that was really the most surreal part of the whole walk, was, you know, 700-800 miles in, I get to Savannah after basically being this rugged homeless transit, and I walk into Liam's movie set just in the middle of the town. I find it, and everyone's like, you know, they wouldn't let me in. They're like, you know, bro, like, you don't know Liam. You're not here. Like, get out of here.
You're homeless.
Thought I was homeless. I looked like a homeless, smelled like one. Liam said he was so, like, you know, tripped out at how bad I smelled. He felt terrible. Like, he was like, he said he kept being nice about it. Like, yeah, bro, just head back to my place. Go take a shower. Just go jump in that shower and then come meet me in a bit. Because when I saw him, it was the coolest thing ever. And wow. Yeah,
okay, I gotta stop you there so we can go back and talk more about it. So you're in New York. You hadn't trained at all. Like,
no,
we're just you had literally just been walking around New York eating food and chilling and stuff like that. And then you go and you get the backpack, you get the I think you got a little mat? Like, not even a sleeping bag, just like a little like yoga mat.
Yeah, this little yoga mat that weighs like less than a pound. REIS magical camping
gear. It looked like one of those things that you put in your windshield to deflect the sun.
Yeah,
in your car.
I think it pretty much was one of those things, but it did be good. My trusty dusty yellow mat.
No blankets?
No blankets. I went to Walmart one day. Everyone was telling me to get some pepper spray because I walked through a couple hoods where it got really scary.
Yeah.
And so at Walmart, I got, I think it was like a big ape suit. And so the ape suit kept me warm, and then I'd throw my sweater on over that.
What do you mean the ape
cold.
Suit?
It was like one of them kid ape suits. It was like
Halloween. a gorilla costume?
Yeah. So I left.
You were
in
walking
September.
Around with a gorilla costume on.
Yeah, at night I'd be walking around that. It got real cold.
Alright, yeah. Okay, so when you're walking and stuff, what was your plan when you started? Did you have a route? Did you have like were you gonna go a certain way, stop
really.
In certain cities,
not
or what'd
really.
You do?
Not really. From the beginning, it was just like, you know, planning, logistics, definitely one of my worst two qualities, two of my worst, and I just didn't want to stress too much on it, so I literally just started walking that first night. I walked through Brooklyn, and then I had to get a ride over the bridge. That was like the one time I got in a car was over the bridge from Brooklyn to Jersey. And then it was, you know, I'd look at the Greenway, take that. But after a while, I was just like, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. This is so intense. I just want to finish this as fast as I can. As much as I enjoyed it, and it was the rush of a lifetime, it was hell. It was...
For sure it was.
So intense. And so
when did your body start breaking down?
Oh, day two.
Like your knees and your back and your ankles.
Day two, I was dead. I call Rick. I'm like, look, I don't think I can do it. I think I'm giving up. He's like, you know, just make it one more day. Just see
how
you do.
And how many days did it take total?
It took 58. And so I was averaging
about... It took 60 days.
Yeah.
And on day two, you were like, I'm done.
Yeah, day two was probably the worst day of the thing. Day one, I did like 25, 30 miles. Just went for it. I'm running. Day two, I wake up just like, I want to kill myself.
Oh, and, for sure. What were you eating?
I was eating, so it was mostly Waffle House. Waffle House's line the East Coast like crazy.
Yeah.
And second, third would be McDonald's and then Dunkin' Donuts and then Starbucks. You know, I was eating oatmeal from McDonald's. I was eating banana bread and stuff from Starbucks.
Basically no nutrition going into your body in one form. What about recovery? Like, where were you sleeping? How would you sleep? Did you have any plans?
So I'd go to Waffle Houses a lot and just kind of post up. I'd sleep outside them sometimes. Some nights, you know, I'd go to a 7-Eleven. I'd get like some Lunchables or something and snacks. And those were the worst. I did a week, I remember, where I was only eating gas station food. And I think within that week, I saw one Pizza Hut, and I ate at the Pizza Hut. But besides that, it was gas station food, which is...
Dude, why was this not all filmed by... Why did you not make an actual film out of this?
Well, I'm going on another walk in a week, so...
All right, we got to talk about that after. But, okay, keep going. Where were you sleeping? Didn't at one point you tell me that you slept in, like, a cemetery and in
a
church?
Yeah. Cemeteries, churches, you know, mostly... outside of these Waffle Houses, under freeways a bit. Sometimes I'd walk through the night to like 5:30, and then I'd find a McDonald's and I'd just post up when the McDonald's opened at like 5 or 6 in the morning and just
buy
one little thing and then just pass out.
Some of the people that you were like running into when you're at these Waffle Houses or at these truck stops, gas stations and shit when you're... Because you literally looked homeless, like you were a homeless person.
Yeah, I was homeless, and people, you know, it was some of the coolest things to see, like, human kindness. Like, people would come up to me, and I remember one guy. This was one of the most, well, the most memorable guy was Jerry Buckley. And Jerry Buckley, so of all the states were good. Everyone told me, you know, Philadelphia and D.C. and Baltimore, you got to watch out. Fayetteville, you're gonna get jumped. Avoid those places. I went through all of them. I wanted to see the ghetto. And I'll tell you what, the gangsters, those guys, they were all cool with me. They were, for the most part, like, oh, he's cool. But then when I got to South Carolina, everyone, like, the whole energy, everything changed. South Carolina was a beast. Worst place ever.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And I met Jerry, I think, at some carnival stop in South Carolina. And he was hitchhiking south. And we ended up hanging out. This guy's like 50 years old. And he's just some homeless dude. Someone ended up looking him up. They were like, Conrad's going to get killed. This guy's so creepy. They looked up his record, and he was just like a minor thief. He would just, you know, steal from like department stores his whole life. So I was hanging out with Jerry. I bought him a beer. This guy was crazy. He was having, you know, a ton of fun. And then 3 days later, and like 100 miles later, I'm walking another street, another town, and I see Jerry Buckley walking the street. And he goes,
yeah, I remember this. Okay, so this is the dude that in the first videos that you took, you were like next to him, and the guy looks like he was gonna kill somebody, like look nuts. Yeah. And then I'm pretty sure you wrote like Jerry or said like, yo, Jerry just went to get some cigarettes. I'm gonna book it. And you yeah. And you ran to get out of there.
And I bailed Jerry, yeah.
And then you bailed and then like 3 days later, he's in your snaps, yeah. He's in your videos again.
Everyone thought he was stalking me and really gonna kill me this time. Everyone was so worried.
And, I was worried for sure.
Yeah, you all thought he was a killer. In real life, he's got a much better presence. But he goes, hey man, you got a cigarette? I'm all, Jerry, it's me. So what are you talking about, man? I'm all, we met
he didn't
at the
remember
carnival.
You?
He's like, what are you talking about? Like, beat it, bro, you crazy. I'm like, Jerry, we hung out 3 days ago up at the gas stop, carnival weird thing. And he's like, whoa, man, that's insane.
No way. Yeah. And yeah. I saw Jerry was one of them. I saw you with another dude with face tattoos and you're chilling.
That was the same story. I hung out with him. We had a great day. I bought him a bunch of mac and cheese from the gas station.
So funny how
you
just become homies with all these guys.
I saw him that night. I got to Savannah, which was another like 3 or 4 days later. And then in Savannah, I went out that night and was hanging with Liam, but he had his movie till like 2 a.m. So I went and roamed the streets. Of all things you'd think I'd do once I finally get to a place, I kept walking around. And I run into this dude in the, you know, downtown, must have sort of been getting to the ghettos, and the guy with the face tats who I'd met 4 days earlier and hung out on the side of the road, and he told me, don't you ever walk on the freeways unless you have a death wish. I've had 17 friends die on the freeways from tire gators, they're called, and they spin off the freaking semi-trucks and kill
from
people.
From what?
They're called tire gators. And a semi-truck, there's some economic incentive for him to just run his tires out instead of changing them, probably insurance or something. And so these tires will fly off the semi-truck, and they've killed people. And
like it's just an actual tire just comes just straight off.
Yeah, or pieces. And one day a piece hit me and it wrapped around my leg and it hurt.
No way.
And it hurt. Yeah.
What was going on with you when you were walking on the highways and you were getting picked up by the cops?
Yeah, so South Carolina especially again was I'm on the walk and I want to like get as fast as possible. And I don't like the freeways, but sometimes I have to, or else I'm going to go like 5 to 10 miles out of my way, which is a lot, even though you think, oh, it's just 5 to 10 out of 1,000. It's still a lot, and it still, you know, makes a little bit of a difference. So I'd walk these freeways, and then in some states, like South Carolina, the cops were like, that's the kid, he's walking, get him. And they'd keep getting me and throw me off on the side roads and make me take routes that took twice as long, because it is dangerous walking on the freeways. But
so you would walk, you would end up walking like 10 miles, which you would end up, you would walk what, like 25 a day?
Yeah, I was walking.
So you'd walk for half a day,
yeah.
Half a day, and then a cop would come pick you up, bring you 10 miles back, and put you on a different road.
Yeah, yeah.
Dude, I mean, that's so brutal.
That only happened once where it was that bad, but it was terrible.
Cops, when they see you, they know you from the news and all that stuff, and when you tell them what you're doing, they still wouldn't be like, all right, well, you're good then, or we'll put you at the same place?
But some people were just gone, you know? Like, most cops were actually cool that I met. I remember this one gas station, though. There was cats outside, and I'm walking for animals, so I'm like, oh, I'm going to buy these cats some food. And so I asked the lady, I'm like, oh, you don't have cat food here, do you? She's like, no, why? I was like, oh, I was going to, you know, feed the cats. She's like, oh, well, we feed them. I was like, oh, cool, you know. And so I bought some sandwich thing for the cats. And I'm outside feeding the cats, and they call the cops on me. And then the cops show up, and they're like, we got some suspicious person, out here just kind of being idle. Like, what are you doing, sir? And I was like, I'm feeding the cats. I'm doing a walk for animals right now. And the cop was laughing. He was like, some people these days, like you were just feeding the cats? I was like, yeah, that's all I've been doing. He's like, oh, I don't know why they called the cops, but whatever.
Wow.
And he was like, you're all good. But the people inside were just, and you could tell, they're just like old kind of hillbillies. And that's, I think, who shot at me. So that was another time.
Yeah, I was going to say, tell me about that when you posted the videos of you getting shot at by a fucking sniper.
Oh, it was the worst thing ever. That was South Carolina again. And that was a bad day because a couple thugs came into a gas station too where I was eating my little Chef Boyardee thing. And I had a couple of them. I was eating like three of these cans of, you know, SpaghettiOs. And he comes up in my face, hey man, you got a lot of food there. How about you give me some of that? And he's right in my face. I'm like, sure, yeah, yeah. And then he's like, ah, oh, and he's laughing with his buddies. And then another one comes up, did the same thing, asking for money, and I was about to hand it to him, and they were like, they'd like smack the table, and we're just kind of like in my face. And that day, I'm walking. Oh, and then I got a photo of another dude.
Was that not the one that you took like a Snapchat of or whatever?
That was the same day. I took a Snapchat of this guy, and some lady told him who was sitting like behind me or something. And oh man, that guy was so pissed. And he was like, you taking photos of me? I'm like, no. And it saved onto my phone. And he's like, give me your phone. And I give him my phone and he saw it. And I thought he was gonna kill me. And he just flipped out. And I was like shaking. I was so scared. Cause it was hood. It was like as hood as it gets.
What were you taking the photo of? It was just a Snapchat one, wasn't it? Just like showing where you were at?
But you know how you can save your snap? No, it was a photo of him because the guy was like, he was sagging down to his like knees. And he was just, you know, and it might have been messed up. I don't know. You decide. But it was culture. And that's what I told him. He was screaming at me. I'm like, bro, you're just the freaking man. This is culture right here. And I'm just kind of a tourist. I'm really sorry. I'm deleting it. I'm an idiot. And luckily, they didn't kill me. But then that same area, I'm walking along. And after I'm walking a bit, it sucks to have to walk like right in the middle of the road where the road and the sidewalk intersect. So there's no sidewalk. So where the road and like the grass intersects, it's scary. Cars come flying by. So I walk on the grass sometimes. And little do I know, I'm walking on someone's property. And I probably, you know, spaced out. And I was probably like 15 to 20 feet into this guy's property, big property. And all of a sudden I hear this, the craziest, loudest bang. And right in front of me, a foot in front of me, just a big explosion, dirt and dust flew into me. And, you know, the only explanation was I got shot at. A mine would have killed me. No explosion that big could have been anything else besides a gunshot. And I ran for half a mile into the woods. I was crying. I got some video of the aftermath.
And yeah, I saw that.
And that nice lady, Queenie Moo, this southern lady, she says she knows that area. And she says, you walk on anyone's lawn, you know, it's shoot first, ask questions later.
Seriously?
Yeah.
It's that intense to where if a person sees, if their house is literally on a main road, and if someone walks on their thing, they might shoot at them?
Yeah, they have the right to shoot. It's crazy. I mean, who knows for sure, but...
Right.
I think still. That's the law. I met a guy, a technician, who would have jobs in South Carolina. I met this guy in Florida. He said he worked up in South Carolina on the walk. I was at some restaurant one night, and he said 10 times, he must have counted 10 times where he went into someone's property and they had forgotten they had a technician appointment and he got shot at. And one time he got hit by shotgun.
Seriously?
Belt. Yeah, and his knee was all messed up. He was like,
so one of the
believe.
Times he actually got shot, like got hit yeah. by a bullet.
Yeah, because
trying to go and fix someone's
yeah,
stuff at their
house.
Yeah,
he worked as a technician and people forget their, like, yeah. He said South Carolina, the worst place ever.
What area of South Carolina was that?
This is like the middle, so I was walking either the 95 or the 85, and
I like the city of Charleston a lot.
Yeah, I didn't get to see Charleston or any of the coast, which was, I'm sure, a lot
okay,
nicer.
Okay, yeah.
But out in the and boondocks.
So you mobbed through South Carolina, and then you got down to Savannah, and that's where you saw Liam and Miley were both down there.
Yeah, Liam was, and it was crazy because that first night was so surreal, best feeling ever. And then he's like, he bought me some clothes, and he's like, look, I'm going to New York. You can just stay here as long as you want. And so I stayed the weekend. I hung out with some of his film crew, and it was an awesome weekend. Savannah by the river, I recommend to anyone. It's Savannah's unreal, and you can go out and you can get drinks and you can walk out of a restaurant or a pub with drinks and cruise down by the river. It's amazing. And so Sunday comes along and I'm like, all right, I'm gonna head out on my walk. I texted Liam, thank you so much, all this. And he was in New York filming SNL with Miley, and they were just flying back to Savannah. And I'm walking out of the city, so I'm walking into the night. It's probably like 10, 11 o'clock at night. And I'm walking into the night. I'm on one of the main roads, but still, get this. I hear, Condor! And a sick SUV pulls over, and Liam and Miley jump out. And we're all just like, you know, this is crazy.
No way, so they actually saw you on your walk.
Randomly. I mean, I knew he was, you know, flying in, but they were just driving back to his place at like 11 o'clock from flying in from New York. And Miley had a couple of acai bowls from New York, and she gave me them. And it was almost like, you know, that gave me fuel, but also gave me like kind of represented, like, this is such a surreal moment being
for
with
sure.
Liam and Miley, who are, you know, such incredible people, but also such like presences in the world. And then to be going out from that world into the night of, you know, being this sort of homeless transit.
Totally refuels you, yeah. Spiritually, mentally, physically, just totally rejuvenates you.
Totally. And such an insane feeling in life.
How long did it take you from Savannah to the border of Florida? I don't know how far that is.
That's another like 100 miles, which was tough. And then when I walked into Florida, a lot of people thought I was done. And I still had another 100 from there.
And so once you were in Florida, didn't was it Kelly Slater?
Yeah.
That asked you to walk more?
Yeah. Well, so first it was I just get into Florida and everyone kind of thinks the walk's done, and so no one warned me that north, I think it, what was the town there? I can't even remember the city name.
Jacksonville,
North Jacksonville,
yeah.
Is as hood as it gets. And I'm
really?
Walking in, and I'm all elated, you know, I'm like, I'm making it through. And these kids are standing on the side of the road, it's like midnight, and they're like, hey, bro, and I'm like, oh, no. And one of them's like, yo, like, can I, you think I can borrow your phone? I gotta call my dad. I'm like, all right. So I'm looking, you know, so I can dial it. But this kid's like, no, I got it, and he's grabbing that, and then he just grabs it and runs. And I had so much adrenaline or something, I chased this kid down, I'm screaming at him, there's a tracker, like, you don't want to do this. And so he's like, I'm catching him, because I'm pretty fast. And so finally he's turning around and like holding the phone out like a weapon while his buddies are kind of nearby. And then I'm like, look, I'll give you money, you don't want to, like, the phone's got a tracker, this is the deal. And so he's like, give me the money, and I'm screaming. So I hand him a 20. That was the craziest story too, because earlier that day, someone had given me that $20 that was just chilling in the top of my pack. just because I was sitting wow. at a McDonald's, and that was the lucky 20, because my phone is life on the walk. Without my phone, I would have been like, you know, panic mode, just dead.
Totally.
And so the kid gave me my phone. I gave him that 20, and
the 20 that wasn't even yours. And had you not had that 20,
yeah, shit could have been real bad. You know, those kids could have had knives or guns. You never know. And looking back, I probably wouldn't have chased them. I would have been like, that was stupid. It was just a phone.
Yeah, absolutely. But how did you even, how were you even like charging your phone and stuff? Because you were posting every day.
Yeah, I had two or three of those Mophie type battery packs. And then, you know, most nights I'd be able to charge up everything at Waffle House in the morning, at Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks. And okay. I tried to be pretty vigilant to keep my charges on, because that was life when you're walking a 5 mile stretch in just nothingness. If I could listen to music or FaceTime you or my friends or go on Insta and post stuff and just be an idiot, you know, anything helped pass the time. Because it's not, you know, a lot of it was definitely spiritual walking, but a lot of it is just get through this thing any yeah, way absolutely. You can. You know?
How is your body towards that? When you got to Florida, how beaten up and like broken down was everything? Did you have any like serious injuries when you were done?
No, I think what it was, and I think most people get this, in that when you do something like that, like I was almost telling my body, like whatever bad like is happening or needs to come, just wait till after. And so as soon as I finished the walk, I got really sick. You know, I got this crazy cough and I was weak and just dead for like a month or two.
Yeah, I believe that.
I wouldn't say right after the walk. I'd say about a week or two after the walk, after the sort of shock of finishing wore off. Then my body just collapsed.
How much do you think of the walk was actually just mental?
I'd say 80-90% was mental.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can walk every day. You can walk that much. It's not...
You're walking a lot, though. And you're not eating and you're not sleeping, too.
Yeah, the food part, that was the worst. And that was the most evident, too. Like, that 1 week where I was only eating gas station food. My spirits were down. I was just bumming. I was
what about water?
Losing my mind.
Water. How much water were you drinking every day? Like, were you carrying a couple water bottles in your backpack?
No, or I guess no. You could... And everyone thinks I'm dumb for this still. I hated any extra weight. And so I was literally just, you know, next gas station, I'll get water. I carried no water with me. Almost never. Yeah. Even if I had like a 10, 20 mile stretch.
Yeah.
I was like, I'd rather risk it. Yeah, because it incentivized me to keep going. Whereas if I had water, it'd slow me down. It'd hurt my back. I hated having any extra weight.
Okay, so you get down to Jacksonville. You get robbed, almost get robbed. And then once you get through there, how far were you from the finish line?
Oh, so I was at the finish line, literally soaking it in. No, Jacksonville, sorry, like probably, I don't know, 3 days, 60 miles or so after Jacksonville was the finish line.
Okay.
And I remember I was just walking through this tunnel looking at Google Maps, because that's how I measured the 1,000 for me for like, you know, doing this was Google Map it. And so I'd Google Map Empire State Building, and I remember it hit I didn't check, you know, and just kind of wanted to actually hit it. And then when I checked, it was 1,001 miles from where I was walking to the Empire State Building. And I felt just so good, just elated. And I'm soaking it up. I'm like, you know, FaceTiming Rick and different people. And then Kelly Slater, who I, you know, most agree is the greatest surfer of all time, and some I consider the greatest athlete of all time, most dominant in any sport. He calls me up and he says, walk to my house. I'm like, yeah, but I look on the map, I'm like, well, it's kind of another 100 miles, and I just did the 1,000. And he's like, well, I'll shout you out and I'll donate and I'll make you a good dinner when you get here. And I said... And I said, guaranteed, when the king calls, Condor beckons the call. You know, this is my hero. And in the moment, it was great. But then the next morning, I was like, damn it, Kelly.
So that's a that was another 100, and that was to what city was he in?
He's in Cocoa Beach, Florida. So it ended up being amazing once I got there. He didn't actually make it. He had some personal business in Costa Rica, but I met a lot of his friends, and it was a great finale either way.
So you ended up walking in total 1,100 miles.
Exactly.
Dude, that's absolutely absurd. With no, you walked 1,100 miles with no equipment, or hardly any equipment, with no plan, no company, no support. Like, just fucking let's do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's wild, man. I give you so much. Wow.
Thanks,
brother. That's a spiritual walk.
Yeah, it's surreal thinking about it, talking about it, and I'm going on another in like a week.
So. Well, how much did it end up raising for the animals?
We raised $111,000 in total. So, I think.
And this was for the Humane Society.
The Humane Society, and then Rick donated a bunch more to this California local organization.
Okay.
So Rick donated in total $100,000, and then we raised like $11,000 just off of people kind of just throwing in like $20 to $100.
Yeah.
And so that was really cool to see, because that was kind of the grassroots effort that we wanted to have happen. So
wow, that's really cool. All right, so tell me about this other walk. You're going on another one? I thought you were gonna invite me to the next one.
Bro, you're invited.
What'd you say? It's in like a week or something like that?
Yeah, it's in a week, but here's the thing is I want this one to be a little mellower, and it's just going to be from San Francisco to San Diego. So it's half as long as the last one. So I'm hoping it'll take me about a month. And I want this one to be more interactive, so whoever wants to kind of come walk for a day or a few hours, I'll be like, look, I'm in Huntington, I'm walking to Newport, come join me. Real simple.
And what is this one just for the spirit of it, or is this a donation, or like for some organization or something like that, or what is it?
Yeah, this one is for pigs. So I thought about a bunch of different causes, but I kind of think in life too, you know, you live your best life, most meaningful life, if you hit home first, if you kind of do what's closest to you and deal with that first. And my brother, he's doing what I thought was the coolest thing ever, is he goes to these Indian reservations, and there's these pigs there, these wild pigs, these little mini boar things. And the people there say, like, we're going to end up killing them, but if you can catch them before we kill them, sure, go take them. And so my brother will literally go out for like 5 hours, and he's got his big old truck, and then he'll chase down pigs until he can catch one. And it'll take him hours to catch one pig, and he's like diving after the thing and chasing them down and trying to corner them. And then he captures them, takes them home, and then finds homes for them. And so
seriously, how big are these pigs?
Like, well, they start off, they're the size of like a little cat, but then they grow into like, you know, big solid pigs. And my brother lives with four of them, and he loves them, and they bite at our feet. And
where does your brother live in?
He lives in Malibu.
And he's got four pigs living with him?
Yeah, sometimes they sleep with him. He's crazy. But I
that's
was like,
unreal.
I was like, you know, I'll do this one for my brother and his pigs.
Absolutely. So, okay. So you're donating the money towards it. Are you getting people to fund it?
I think so. I haven't really, like, this one, I don't want, like, as, you know, sort
big
of thing.
Of a deal?
Like, you know, I felt kind of bad. Like, Rick's paying me money and, you know, everyone. This one, I just kind of want it, like, a little mellower and, but it's gonna be it's called Betsy's Pig Foundation, and so yeah, we're raising money for sure, and I don't know who runs the foundation, but my brother knows all that stuff, and I mean it's okay. My brother's whole life, so I'm like, all right, I'm just doing it for your thing, you take care of all that, because I'm like, you know what you're doing's cool, and no one knows it. Like, my brother doesn't tell a single person, and he that's like his whole life right now is he. and he loves it too, but he's just out getting these pigs, saving these pigs. Every weekend he's driving to some like ranch or Indian reservation and he's getting the pigs.
Wow.
So I was like, I'm gonna
San Francisco to San Diego.
For the pigs, yeah.
For the pigs. How long is that gonna, how long are you planning on, how many miles is that?
550, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm gonna go in a week. I already got my ticket to San Francisco.
Seriously?
Yeah.
So calling out to anybody that's out in that area or along that whole coast. Are you gonna do the coast? Are you gonna walk the coast or are you gonna walk the five?
I'm gonna walk, I'm not sure yet. I gotta see the different incentives. Because I'll tell you what, like the last one, I was gonna walk the coast, but then I was like, that's a whole like 100 miles out of the way. And then, but there's a lot of weird marshes in like North Carolina and whatnot. And then I was like, oh, I'm gonna do the Appalachian Trail when I get to DC.
Yeah.
And then I got to DC. And I was at Humane Society, and this girl's telling me the story. She said, oh, my two girlfriends went out and hiked the Appalachian Trail. I said, oh, nice. She's like, no. They were out there, had the time, la-di-la. They get home, and they developed their film camera, and there's photos of themselves sleeping.
No fucking way. You yeah. are kidding me.
I'm not kidding.
What?
So then I was like, I'm not taking the AT. I was planning
what?
On everything. Yeah.
You're telling me that these girls were literally camping, went to sleep, came home,
yeah.
developed the camera, and there was pictures on the camera of them sleeping.
Yes.
Dude, that's the scariest thing I've ever heard in my life.
Can you believe that?
No, like, didn't get robbed, didn't get, like, no, didn't hear anybody, and literally there's pictures of them sleeping.
No,
fuck
just
that.
Some ghost or dude just wanted to create the scariest thing
that's
ever.
That's
something.
Literally the most scary thing I've ever heard in my life.
I know, and that was an instant I never could go back. I was like, there's no way I'm taking the Appalachian Trail. There's not a chance.
Were you not spooked out at all on the whole walk? Like not, like, scared for, like, in the hood, like, but like actually like spooked out of anything during the middle of the night or a place
oh,
they're
yeah.
sleeping at
yeah.
a cemetery?
Yeah, it'd get real dark at times. I'd get so scared. Some nights I'd just start, you know, I'd get so scared I'd start crying. It was like so, Virginia had these long stretches where of nothingness and, you know, of like weird ghosts or things or just eerie thoughts. Yeah, but also bears. I had two
isn't
people
Roanoke,
tell me there's
isn't
bears.
Isn't Roanoke out there? Didn't you walk through that area?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that name.
Oh,
walked
my God.
Walked through that for
man.
Sure. Yeah, there were bears. I didn't see any. Well, I might have seen one night. There was a big old sucker cruising around. I just, silent, just didn't move a muscle. Just stiff as a board. That was scary.
The whole like, just everything about that you went through is just so you. It's, just
yeah,
such,
right?
it's such an experience that you would go through. It's unreal. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
All right. So the new walk is in a week. The new walk is coming in a week. San Francisco to San Diego for the pigs, for Betty. Betty's
yeah.
pigs.
Betty's pigs coming
Is that
up.
What it is? Betty's pigs?
I think it's Betsy, but
Betsy.
Betty, she won't mind.
For Betsy's pigs.
Betsy the pig.
I would say that we should talk about the Bitcoin and stuff like that, but I feel like we should save that for a whole another one since this is already an hour and a bit.
Yeah, let's do Bitcoin on another podcast, and then
yeah.
you know we could do another one. Current thoughts on life.
Oh, I would love that because now
Bitcoin
just
and
now
life.
So that people that are listening now, you're back. You're in Malibu. Well, you're not. I don't know if you're permanently in Malibu, but you're not in Russia anymore. You're not on the walk. You're actually doing crypto trading, and I feel like the next podcast is going to be another really important one because of all this information and stuff like that you know about that whole space.
Yeah, it's a hot topic right now, and I got some – I lucked out in that I have some really in connections in crypto. And so I
But you
I
also
get a lot
have
of info.
A – you also are really intelligent with that stuff because your background is finance.
Yeah, I know how to read patterns, numbers, and people. And if you know how to read patterns, numbers, and people, you can make some pretty good predictions.
Totally.
All right. So. Well, I think that's all. We got to wrap it up then.
Yeah, brother.
But thank you so much. Your story is most entertaining one I've had in a while, for sure.
Good. I love
the walk. The walk never stops. The walk's still going on right now. The walk of life.
The walk goes on.
The walk goes on for the condor, for the world, for the kids, for the animals.
Hell yeah.
All right, brother. Thank you for doing that.
Yeah, for sure. Loved having this chat with you. You're my boy.
Absolutely, bro.
Awesome.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening. I love y'all. If you have any questions or concerns or it sparked something that I said that you want to ask me about, send me a message on Instagram at JT Barnett. If you're listening to this on Anchor, you can send me a voice message. If you're listening to this on iTunes, you can leave a review or subscribe. Or if you're listening to it, I think it's on Spotify. I'm not sure if it's on Spotify yet, but whatever ones you're on, subscribe if you can so that you got my updates when anything comes up. And like I said, if you got any questions, please feel free to message me. I try to get back to all of them. Thank you so much for listening. I'm out. I'll talk to you guys again soon. All right.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.